Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Dana Buckler Show. My name is Dana, and I am joined by my regular co-host for this series on the evolution of the vampire film, Ashley. Welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's good to be back, Dana.
It's definitely been too long, and I'm super happy to have you back on to talk the evolution of the vampire films, but I don't know if I'm necessarily super excited to talk about this movie, and we'll get into that in just a little bit. First, just give the listeners a quick little update. How have things been going for you? Everything good?
Everything's been great. Things have been rolling along here in Houston in the hottest summer that I can ever remember us having here in Houston. But yeah, it's good. Summer's almost over. So,
and I'd like to say, meanwhile here in Florida, we're like, the heat. Yep.
It's fun. We have spent lots of time in water this summer.
I can imagine. But I've actually spent a lot of time in the pool where I live as well. And it's what you have to do. So we're going to talk about the idea for this episode, and we were just talking before we hit record, I came up with the idea, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the television series, had to be a part of this discussion of the evolution of the sword. I know it's not a film, but it's so, you know, cemented in the pop culture as far as vampire pop culture that talking about the series, we would be doing the listeners a disservice if we didn't talk about the series. But I was sort of like, well, we have to talk about the movie because the movie, without the movie, we don't get the series. And unfortunately, I don't know if I necessarily would have said that if I had revisited the movie prior to agreeing to do this one. So that being said, Ashley, the first question I have for you today is, can you talk just a little bit about the cultural significance of Buffy, both the movie and then into the TV series, without getting too much into the TV series, because we're going to do an episode on that, but just talk a little bit about what Buffy means to you and what it means to so many people.
I mean, I don't think that the importance of Buffy in my own life can be overstated. I mean, we are getting very much into the geek territory that I love the most. As many times that I fangirl out on multiple occasions, Buffy is the thing that is by far the closest to my heart. And I think a lot of the reason is because I am a part of the generation that watched Buffy in real time. So we were the age of Buffy in the TV series. She was a year older than I was, the character was. And so there's a whole group of girls, myself included, that were incredibly inspired by this new type of heroine that had, but at least that I had not seen before. And that kind of is, you know, the nexus of where Buffy came from. I know we're going to get a little bit into Joss Whedon because we have to talk about Joss Whedon because Buffy is his brainchild and his baby. But, you know, that's why Joss Whedon created Buffy. In the 80s, he began to develop this kind of distaste for what was happening with horror movies and the slasher films that started to come on scene starting in the 70s with, you know, Friday the 13th and Last House on the Left, and then progressing through the Nightmare on Elm Streets and the Halloweens and in the 70s and all of that. He was disgusted by this idea of the big-breasted, ditzy blonde that had sex and got killed immediately afterward. And he has been quoted as talking about this kind of, you know, character type and how he wanted to screw with the cliche and have that ditzy blonde kick the monster's ass, kick the killer's ass in the end. And that is kind of where Buffy arrived. And she, in the movie and in the TV series, she's the same character. We'll get into some of the differences, but that's basically the concept of who Buffy is and what he was trying to do with Buffy, which in 1992, when the movie was created, was a new idea for what a sex symbol like Christy Swanson, who played her, the fact that she was a heroine and could take care of herself, that cultural significance in the early 90s and then repeated 5 years later in 97 when the TV series premiered, it just became a moment. It became a moment, and you will get no argument from me about truly saying that Buffy the television show, which this movie inspired, it changed TV forever. And none of that would have ever happened without the movie. And the problems that we're going to go into, that aside, it created this cultural phenomenon that continues into today.
Can you talk a little bit about what Whedon was doing around the same time as Buffy? I mean, what was, you don't just come out of nowhere and write the screenplay and it gets turned into a movie. He had done some interesting and notable work prior to this, correct?
He had. I mean, Joss Whedon, I mean, he's a household name now. You know, those of us that, you know, worship at the altar of geekdom know so much about who Joss Whedon is. But when Buffy came out, he wasn't the person that he is today. He certainly wasn't the powerhouse that he has become. You know, Whedon began really about 1989 was when he got his big breaks on the professional scene, 3 years before this movie would come out. And he was a staff writer on multiple sitcoms, Roseanne, for example, being one of them. And he was also what they call in the industry a script doctor. So they would give him films that weren't necessarily, you know, they weren't necessarily what people wanted. The writing wasn't great, but the story was there, and he would doctor the scripts. And he has absolutely no credit for these films, but he was a script doctor on Waterworld, on Speed, on Twister. And he also began some of the early drafts of movies that eventually would become the first X-Men film of the entire series. I mean, he began to become this prolific storyteller and this world creator. And that is where he found himself when Buffy would come onto the screen. And speaking of Whedon, I think that we would be remiss to not talk about, you know, just how important he's been to movies in general. A lot of people don't know, for example, that he co-wrote Toy Story, the first Toy Story. He co-wrote Titan A.E., which I think is a wonderful film. And he would go on to create Angel, the spinoff of Buffy, Firefly, which is, in my opinion, one of the best sci-fi series ever. The movie Serenity that continued the story of Firefly, the TV show Dollhouse, the absolutely amazing horror film, The Cabin in the Woods. He wrote and directed the first Avengers film. And his connection with comics wasn't just in the movie industry. I mean, he also was a very prolific comic book writer himself. He created the Astonishing X-Men series, which a lot of people, if you're not familiar with the comics but are with the movies, the whole concept that X-Men 3 explores, where there's a cure for being a mutant, that all came from Whedon's comic book series. He was the second writer on Marvel's The Runaway comic book series. And I could go on and on with his resume. And Buffy was just something that solidified him in the industry, but it certainly has not been his only important contribution to these many different nerdy worlds.
It's kind of incredible too, because there's a vast difference amongst all those different titles and properties that you've talked about. And you know, you get certain writers that are really good at one type of genre or one style. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about him, I mean, you mentioned being the script doctor on Speed and Waterworld and Toy Story. I mean, these are vastly different films from each other. It's pretty remarkable what he did back then. And I mean, he really came into his own after the Buffy series, correct? I mean, when did he appear on your radar? When did you know who he was?
For me, it was Buffy the TV show, because I remember watching the premiere of the Buffy television show, because again, with my age, I watched the WB all the time. I watched Dawson's Creek. I watched that show Roswell. I watched all those shows that were on the WB, Buffy being one of them. And that's when I learned who Joss Whedon was. And then I also, after the fact, got very into Firefly, which would come in the early 2000s, and kind of just followed his career, because Whedon has always written women and these female characters in a way that has very much appealed to me, and that's not uncommon amongst people my age. You know, there was a feminist undertone to all of his writing and to all of the characters that he created in these shows. I mean, just look at Serenity. I mean, that's another really powerful female figure. Dollhouse is another one. The female protagonist in Cabin in the Woods. You know, he creates these wonderful female characters that began for us in pop culture with Buffy, but continued throughout, which, you know, I think we would be remiss to not talk about, you know, what happened in 2017, which was a big letdown for those of us that were big Joss Whedon fans, when his ex-wife came out with that scathing open letter after they divorced about the number of extramarital affairs that he had, and how he was this incredibly deceitful man because he actually didn't care anything about women, and that he had fired, an actor from the Buffy series because she was pregnant, and all these other instances of him actually not looking out for women. And I was having a conversation with one of my friends before recording this, because they also are a huge Buffy fan, and they're like, you know, how are you going to talk about Joss Whedon, because it's so complicated now. And, you know, I think that you have to have some sense of almost cognitive dissonance as a woman that consumes pop culture. And so I think you have to kind of separate out what Buffy is, because Buffy is not Joss Whedon. Buffy is its own thing. But I don't think you can take away his contribution to the movie and television industries. But again, I also think it would be remiss to not at least mention the, you know, the little bit of Stranger Danger that certainly came out in 17.
Did he come out and, as far as you know, because I genuinely was not really following what happened in 2017, did he ever make a statement? Did he ever confirm, deny, any kind of statement about this open letter that was written about him?
I mean, I to be very honest with you, I don't think so. I mean, I think a lot of what has happened with the Me Too movement is that smart men know to just kind of shut up when this essay came out. I know that his spokesperson, you know, came out with your typical, response of there's inaccuracies, there's misrepresentations, and, you know, all that type of thing. But he did not address directly the misuse of power. He did not directly address any of her accusations of him being anti-women rather than pro-women like he had made himself out to be. And I think that's what's kind of ironic is, you know, if you go to his Wikipedia page, one of the largest sections of the page is about feminism and about what he has done for the modern woman, now arguably for the modern white woman, because he typically does not deal in any other area. But I do think that it's really interesting to think about that juxtaposition of all of what he has done to make women feel empowered, and then for Kai Cole, his ex-wife, to come out and say all of this. But no, I don't think he said anything, and I think he's smart to not say anything, to just not address it.
Interesting. Okay,
that's real. And maybe that's why his career hasn't gone anywhere. You know, he's still working, and all these other, you know, I mean, look what happened to James Gunn with the tweets on Twitter when he came out and, you know, responded. Look at what's happened to other actors, you know, when they have been accused of things, you know, their careers have been destroyed, and in many cases rightfully so. But I think taking that, you know, the letting her be heard, I think was a smart move on his part. So,
okay. All right. Interesting. Let's talk about the movie just for a moment here, just to bring people up to speed just a little bit here. Buffy the Vampire Slayer was this, according to what I read here, Whedon sold the film to Dolly Parton's production company. And we're going to talk a little bit about the cast first, because part of the production has to do with the cast. I'm just going to listeners, if you've never seen Buffy the Vampire Slayer, you're not going to believe me when I tell you who is in this movie. You're going to be astounded. It's Christy Swanson, Luke Perry, Rutger Hauer, RIP, Donald Sutherland, Paul Rubens, Hilary Swank, David Arquette, Stephen Root, with very extra performances by Ben Affleck, Ricky Lake, Seth Green, Alexis Arquette. This is a who's who of
Thomas, you know, Jane.
Thomas Jane. Thomas Jane. I did forget Thomas Jane. Yeah, no, I mean, this is an insane cast. I mean, what are your thoughts just on the cast alone here?
Well, I mean, so many of them were two B's, right? Like, exactly. they weren't horribly famous or famous at all when this came out. I mean, Christy Swanson was a sex symbol. This, I think, in a lot of ways was meant to be kind of her pivot into more of a leading lady. That, of course, as we know, did not happen after the film. But, you know, there was her. I mean, Luke Perry was certainly one of your biggest names. I mean, I'm quite sure the only reason this film with the title it had got greenlit at the time was because of Luke Perry being attached to it. You know, he was at the height of his 90210 stardom. And I mean, I remember being obsessed with Luke Perry when I was young. So it made sense. But I mean, I think it's incredible. Donald Sutherland and Rutger Hauer alone, you know, are such big names that, you know, they I think were meant to anchor it, you know, meant to give it that little bit of acting chop. But it is incredible how many people became famous after this, especially with the types of performances that they give in this film. I mean, who would have thought after watching Hilary Swank's performance with the amount of scrunchies she had in this film that she would become a two-time Oscar winner following, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. But it's nuts to see, you know, who would be.
No, it is. And it was when I was watching the movie today and the basketball scene, and it's just Ben Affleck, and I'm just going, whoa, what? Like, I didn't even, because I didn't really look at any behind the scenes until after I watched the movie. And I'm like, well, there's Batfleck right there. Like, what's going on here? Like, this is just, it's kind of incredible here.
But I feel like that's the early 90s for Ben Affleck. He pops up in the most random movies, and it's usually with Matt Damon, right? I mean, this is one of the few that wasn't with Matt Damon, because, like, there's the crazy, you know, fact that Ben Affleck is in School Ties with, you know, Brendan Fraser and Matt Damon. Like, I feel like Ben Affleck always randomly pops up, and he was such a gawky, like, you know, awkward guy in the early 90s, but I feel like that's just Ben Affleck's resume, his little CV from from the early 90s.
And I want to talk about sort of each of these actors, the performances they give one by one, but we have to talk about one actor in particular in this one, and that's Paul Reubens, because this movie came out in 92. In 91, Paul Reubens, for those who don't know, that is his stage name, is Pee Wee Herman. That is essentially who he is known as. And in the 1980s, there was really no bigger force in, and especially in children's television, than Pee Wee Herman. He did in 85, he did Pee Wee's Big Adventure, directed by Tim Burton, which I still to this day say is an amazing film that I think everybody, if you haven't seen it, definitely needs to check out. I say this was controversial because this movie came out a year after he had a, what would be, I guess, best described as a, I won't say a career ruining situation, but it certainly changed, forever changed the course of his career. And can you talk a little bit about what happened to him in 1991 and why his casting would have been so controversial at the time?
Well, he was there in your state, Florida.
Yes, Sarasota specifically, yeah.
Very, very nice Florida reference here. Paul Reubens, he was visiting relatives in Sarasota, Florida, and he attended an adult movie theater, and he was arrested for masturbating during the film. You know, it was a raid, and unfortunately, I mean, he did not make matters much better for himself when they went to arrest him, and his response was, well, I'm Pee Wee Herman, and he offered to do a children's benefit for the sheriff's office.
Yes.
That did not go over well, but you know, he had kind of become a pariah of sorts after that. And you know, this was pre, I think for our younger listeners, this was pre-internet. You know, today TMZ would have been all over this, but back in the early 90s, scandals like this were few and far between amongst people in Hollywood. And so the fact that this made the national news, the fact that, you know, they were talking about this on the 5 o'clock news and my parents knew about it, I mean, that's why it was so career ending, is because this was not a common, you know, occurrence in the early 90s. And this was a really big deal to have that kind of scandal hit. And unfortunately it did. And he, you know, he pleaded no contest. And, you know, he did, I think he did 75 hours, I think is what I read, of community service. And he did some anti-drug public service announcements. And it was very, you should actually look them up on YouTube, because there's one of Pee Wee Herman explaining why it's bad to use cocaine. And if you were a child in the 80s or early 90s and watch Pee Wee Herman, to watch Pee Wee Herman explain to you why cocaine and crack is bad, that crack is whack, it is such a weird mind fuck. So I encourage all of you to seek them out. But that's what he did. And, you know, it was a big deal for him to get cast after that.
And what's interesting is you alluded to the fact that this is all pre-internet, pre-social media. I think it was probably thought that situations like this could be swept under the rug. And, you know, given, you know, I think it makes you wonder what other things happened in the 60s, 70s, 80s and all this stuff before everybody had a phone, everybody had a camera, and everybody could instantly connect with each other. But I kind of chuckled out loud about when I was reading about the fact that he offered to do children's plays as a way to sort of make this all go away.
You know, I do have to give him credit, though. I mean, I think he's this really stand up guy, because I remember the story about it happening. And then there was that big deal where in 91, he went at the end of the year, he went on the MTV Music Video Awards, and he went out as Pee Wee Herman, and he stepped on stage and famously said, "Have you heard any good jokes lately?" You know, because that's all anyone had talked about. And that takes a big person to do that, because I mean, you got caught jerking off in a, you know, a porn theater. Like, first of all, gross, second of all, sketchy, third, how embarrassing. And I mean, and I think it wouldn't have been such a big deal if he hadn't been a child actor. I think, you know, like, not a child actor, I apologize, you know, someone who performed for children. I mean, imagine if Mr. Rogers was caught in some, like, you know, rest stop scandal. I mean, that would be a big deal for, you know, people, especially in the early 90s, which were much more puritanical, if you can believe it, than today. But I do want to give a shout out to A Current Affair, because A Current Affair, this was one of their first big stories that they covered. That was such a big part of the early 90s, was that television show. That was our TMZ in the early 90s, was A Current Affair. And they made his life an absolute living hell.
And it did, like I mentioned, forever changed the direct trajectory of his career. I mean, from that point on, you know, he was very scandalous in the 1990s. And it's an interesting thing. I think the fact that there was no internet, I think he was able to recover, because I don't know if in this day and age in 2019, if you ever recover from something like that. I don't know if it's possible.
Well, look at what happened to him in 02, you know, because he was arrested again in 2002 in that raid on his home. It was connected to another person's child pornography case. And it was another actor. His name is Jeffrey Jones. And so they raided Paul Rubens' home as well. Actually, while he was filming the video for Elton John's This Train Don't Stop There Anymore in 2002, they raided his home and they collected, I mean, upwards of 70,000 things. And they claim that there was child pornography there. And, you know, Paul Rubens has always stated, no, 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 this was like a kitsch item collection. You know, this was stuff, old Victorian stuff. He admitted to having Rob Lowe's sex tape, which, by the way, I need to go find Rob Lowe's sex tape because I did not know that existed.
Oh, I remember that.
You know, I will be visiting, I don't know what, you know, YouTube Red this weekend or Pornhub to go seek out Rob Lowe's sex tape. But, you know, I mean, it, you know, he admitted to having that, but it was really awful. And he wound up having to plead guilty to a lesser charge so they would drop the child pornography. And it later came out that none of it was child pornography, but it completely destroyed him. Because by 2002, things were a little bit different than in 91. We had a little bit more information. We were you know, it was the birth of the internet a few years before, and he has never recovered from that. And so just looking at the juxtaposition of his career kind of getting restarted and then just being totally stopped with something he didn't even do, I think tells the story of what happens to actors today.
You know, we talked a little bit about Joss Whedon, and to talk about this movie is to talk about the fact that he has practically, and you would know better than I, he has, for lack of a better term, completely disowned this movie. Would you agree?
Oh, completely.
Okay. Because according to what I was reading here, he was brought on as an advisory role early in the production, but he departed. He was completely dissatisfied with the direction the film was taking. And after he left, they completely gutted his script.
Well, you know, he famously walked off set. I mean, he famously walked off set while they were filming, and it was a combination, from what he has shared since then, it was a combination of the director not going in the direction that he wanted. It was a combination of Christy Swanson not quite being who he wanted Buffy to be, which he's been honest that it wasn't her fault. It was the way that the script was being recrafted. And then Donald Sutherland kept rewriting his lines on the spot, you know, that he just got really pissed about. He stripped all the Whedonisms out of the script, because Joss Whedon has a very specific way of writing, and more so, he has a very specific way of writing for teenagers, almost like a Kevin Williamson. Kevin Williamson writes teenagers so well. Look at Green, look at Dawson's Creek. He writes teenagers beautifully. And that's the same thing with Whedon. They, you know, there's a very specific tonality and a very specific cadence to the way that their scripts are read and they progress. And Donald Sutherland was just, you know, taking it all out and being, I don't know, maybe he was reliving his, you know, previous horror career, but, you know, he's very serious and rewrote all these lines. And so Joss Whedon famously, you know, walked out.
And that's what's interesting, is because going into watching it today, I'm of the mindset that this is a completely Joss Whedon-based script, and I'm failing to find any of the humor in any of this. And I have to tell you, you know, it wasn't warming me up to the idea of sitting down to Buffy. I was like, to the TV series, I was like, oh, maybe I'm not missing anything. And then to read that he basically, I mean, can you talk, I mean, you mentioned a little bit about, you know, he writes teenagers, but what was his, I mean, do you know what his script was really going to be like? Like what was different? What did the studio take out?
I mean, there were a lot of things. And if you're interested, for listeners, the original script actually was put in comic book form. There's a comic book and it's called The Origin. That's where you can find the original screenplay for what he had intended for the Buffy the Vampire movie, and it progresses. The Buffy the Vampire comics are really fun, if any of you are interested. After season 7 of Buffy the television show, he did a comic book series of like a season 8, a season 9. They're fantastic. But basically what he had intended is kind of what we talked about previously, where he wanted to have this kind of ditzy blonde who actually was a badass. And what wound up happening is the director and her husband owned the rights. They purchased the rights to the story so they could do you know, whatever they wanted to the story. But they not only strip the humor, because that's what you said, there isn't a lot of humor in this film. But I would say more than that, what Joss Whedon always has, especially with his teen and his female writing, is there's a self-awareness to his scripts. There's a self-awareness to his movies and his television shows. And I mean that in terms of both the characters are self-aware and the movie itself is self-aware. It knows what it is. I mean, the fact that he named the film and the television show Buffy the Vampire Slayer, it's supposed to be funny. It's supposed to be comical. It's supposed to make you go, huh? And he, they stripped out all of that self-awareness, all of that almost parody moments. And the only moment of this movie that is Joss Whedon-esque is the Paul Reubens death scene, which was completely improvised, but he had read the original script, and some of his lines you can see where, like, the future character of Xander in the television show is going to come from. You can see with Luke Perry's character, he's like a mix of you know, Angel and a little bit of Xander too that's to come. And so they stripped out all of those things that he was able to put back together and create these characters that were very standalone and were not just cookie cutter. And the movie feels boring and it feels very fake. And I know that sounds silly because it's a vampire movie, but it doesn't feel like it knows what it is. It doesn't know what it wants to be. Is it a teen comedy? Is it a horror film? Is it a parody? It doesn't know. And it just reads as flat as a result of that.
And what's interesting is because, again, going into this movie thinking that I enjoyed it when I saw it, when it came out, and I'm watching Buffy with her friends, and I'm expecting, you know, the sharp, witty Heather's style, the Clueless style, that smart, you know, Valley girl, you know, Beverly Hills socialite type. And I'm not getting any of that in this movie.
You know, I'm really glad you brought up Clueless because I have a note here. I think that this movie may have been a different experience if it had come out in 97 rather than which is when the television show came out, rather than in 92, because I think Clueless changed so many things about what the 90s teen girl was going to be moving into the early 2000s. And Cher in Clueless, she's ditzy, she's blonde, but she knows herself and she's confident in herself and she is a very developed character. And in this movie, Buffy is not. She just reads as a caricature of what the Valley girl, blonde, you know, everything he didn't want it to be. She was a caricature of everything that he didn't want the big-breasted, beautiful, blonde girl to be. And, you know, there were some very specific changes that he made as a result of seeing the movie when he created the television show, because I have a quote here from him. He says that, you know, because he sat down and he watched the film and he said that it was a start, but she's not quite the girl. And he realized that even in his script, he didn't fully know who Buffy was. And that's why you see some changes. You see Buffy become a sophomore in the television show rather than a senior. You see her in the television show already start by knowing she's a slayer. So they didn't have to do the transition of her being an airhead to this well, you know, developed character. She already knew all that backstory, and the movie suffers from her. You know, Christy Swanson is an airhead the first half, and then she's too grown up the second half. And it doesn't read. The transition happens too quickly. And so he fixed that. And in the Buffy TV show, which we'll talk about in our next episode, the character of Cordelia very much is what Christy Swanson's character is in this movie. It's almost, I don't know if it's a tribute, I don't know if it's shade, I don't know what it is, but that character of Cordelia, played by Charisma Carpenter, is very much what Christy Swanson is the first half of this film. So I think even he knew. And the only other quote I have here that I thought was interesting from him is that he said that the movie doesn't look like a dry run. It looks like a really messy first draft, and that he was able to redo and fix when he came and sat down and rewrote the television show with Marty Noxon, which we'll get into in our next episode, the importance that she played in that rewrite.
And you basically just answered the first question, where I want to talk a little bit about each of the characters sort of one by one. And you sort of talked about how she, the character of Buffy, Christy Swanson's character, you know, very ditzy in the beginning, and then be just like a switch gets flipped and she becomes this very strong, you know, very powerful person. I'm excited to watch Buffy, the TV series, even more now because the flaws that I saw in this character sounds to me have been, since with episode one of Buffy, they were cleared up.
They have. And I just want to say this too. I mean, Christy Swanson, I think, did the best with what she was given. But in the end, Sarah Michelle Gellar, the acting chops that she had were just so much, there was so much more depth, and she's such a better actress that the Christy Swanson character, you feel no connection to her. You don't feel sorry for her. You don't feel happy for her. You feel nothing. And, you know, when you watch the series, and for those of you preparing for our episode, if you watch the series, you know, Sarah Michelle Gellar from the first season, you feel this deep connection to her, to who she is. And she's a person, not just this, you know, this random character that was crafted. So.
You know, not to backtrack just real quick, because this sort of just popped in my mind. This is an incredibly short movie, 86 mm-hmm. minutes long. And I'm wondering if Whedon's script was longer. 1 page = 1 minute. That's basically the industry standard for screenwriting. So I'm wondering if Whedon's script ran longer than 86 pages. Do you have any idea?
I don't remember. No, I don't. I think it may have been a little bit longer, but I don't think it was horribly longer. And I think that's what Joss Whedon has been so honest about, is this was not at all what he wanted for his Buffy. But when he watched it, even watching it, he realized that his own version of Buffy was not quite right. And so, you know, those of us that are such huge fans of the show, we don't watch the movie, but we're so grateful to it because it's what gave us Buffy, the television show. If he had had his perfect Buffy movie, we never would have gotten the Sarah Michelle Gellar iteration. So even if it had been a little bit longer, I don't think it would have fixed some of the issues that we're talking about, but it definitely, I think it would have been a better film, but it certainly, don't want to insinuate that it would have been a perfect one.
You mentioned that this movie gets off the ground, essentially gets the budget, gets 20th Century Fox behind it because of the casting of Luke Perry. This was at the height of 90210, like you mentioned. And of course, I know I'm a few years older than you, but I was big in the 90210 thing as well. That was big on me. Luke Perry plays the character of Pike, Oliver Pike. My analysis from watching the film today is that he was playing Dylan McKay. Essentially the same. I think they literally hired him to play Dylan McKay with a different name. Your thoughts on that?
I think he was Dylan McKay without Dylan McKay's money.
Correct.
Right, because he's meant to be of a different socioeconomic class in the film. But for sure, I mean, you know, here's the deal about Luke Perry, and God knows I miss Luke Perry. I'm so sad that he passed away in March. I really genuinely enjoyed Luke Perry as an actor. But I think your problem is twofold. One, this movie suffers because of Luke Perry, because they shot it in only 5 weeks because they had to accommodate Luke Perry's shooting schedule for 90210. And I think any film that's shot in just 5 weeks always suffers from, you know, some issues, right? But the other thing is that even though I love Dylan McKay, come on now, Dylan McKay's not a teenager. Like, right. He's just not. And Luke Perry was in his 30s when Buffy the Vampire Slayer came out. You know, he was in his 30s when he filmed, when he was filming the 90210 series. I mean, he was not a teenager, and he never came across in 90210 like a teenager. And he certainly doesn't come across in this film like a teenager, which you're going to see when you watch a TV show. One of the things they do best is the people that play the teenagers. They either were young, or like Allison Hannigan was very young. Sarah Michelle Gellar was very young. But even when they weren't, like Charisma Carpenter, who was very close to Luke Perry's age, when she started filming Buffy the Vampire series TV show, they act like teenagers. They capture that. And this movie just did it. And Luke Perry, I think, is the worst example of that.
Just a quick note on David Arquette, because he certainly had his character, Benny, had the maturity level of a teenager in the film. But my God, I just never wanted someone to be off the screen more than when he was on screen. I don't have issues with David Arquette. I love him in Scream. I think he's so perfectly cast as Dewey in Scream. This was, I don't know what was going on with this performance.
Yeah, I mean, I've always thought David Arquette is super annoying. I mean, I like him in the Scream series, okay. You know, he's whatever. But I've always thought he's super annoying. He's really super annoying in this movie. And the makeup, his makeup when he becomes a vampire is so bad. It's so bad.
But that's kind of across the board with the exception of, I think, of Paul Rubens, who I thought looked good, and we'll talk about him in just a second. I even thought the practical makeup effects in this film weren't even good, because, and the sad thing is, by this point, you've got other vampire movies. You've got other reference points as far as what, you know, your vampire should look like. I mean, I know this is before Bram Stoker's Dracula. It's the same year, and I know it's before Interview with the Vampire, but you've got Fright Night. You've got Interview with the Vampire. You've got Salem's Lot. You've got examples. And this just didn't even look good.
No, it looked like what I would do before a Halloween party with my makeup skills. I mean, seriously, like it was terrible. And, you know, and you'll see on the television show, the bumpy heads, when they turn into vampires, it's very much an homage in a lot of ways to the Lost Boys. And the way when my brother was in town for my birthday 2 weeks ago, and he had never seen the Lost Boys before, and I was like, how have you never seen the Lost Boys? So we sat down to watch it, and he's a huge Buffy the Vampire Show fan, and he went, oh my god, Joss Whedon ripped these guys off. He's like, this is exact. And I was like, no, it's like, you know, it's an homage. It's so crazy to watch the Lost Boys, how much the reference point is there. And so I just think it's terrible that a television show on the WB, which was not a well-funded network yet in 97, Buffy and Dawson's Creek would be the reason it became such a well-funded network. But the fact that the makeup effects are better there than this well-funded 20th Century Fox film, I think, is just an atrocity. And again, it's confusing. You know, is the makeup bad because they're trying to be bad, or is it bad because they didn't know what to do? Or it's just all very confusing.
Yeah. And what was interesting is, you know, when she's having those dreams about being in, you know, colonial times, I was more interested in what was happening there. And that was just a brief snippet. Like, we didn't get much of that. And that seemed to be like a more interesting arc than the story that was being told.
Yeah, I mean, you'll see that on the television show. I mean, that's very much a Joss Whedon thing. You know, when we get our backstories of Angel and Spike and all of that, you have entire episodes that are set in other time periods. And other vampire films have picked up on that, or vampire television shows. That vampire show that was on television, The Vampire Diaries, I mean, so much of that show plays that Joss Whedon thing where they go back and show how the characters were created and they go back to their times. I mean, it's without any of the humor or self-awareness. I mean, that's not a great show, but, you know, it's very much the same thing. And so I think that that was fine. But I think what the problem is, when you have a movie that's such a short amount of time, those things take you out of it. Those were opportunities for us to get to know the character. Those were opportunities for us to understand who the Slayer is and what the Watchers are. I mean, you're trying to create a world in this film, because every vampire film has to create, as we've talked about in this whole series, they have to create its own lore. And they did not spend enough time, other than that awful intro yeah. with the voiceover. That's really, you know, all we get. And I mean, Joss Whedon, you know, he hits the ball out of the park with the television show with the opening, because he does that in the opening of the television show. But it's like two sentences, and even that's better than the way that they do it in the film. So it was just so much wasted opportunity that you just don't know who these people are. And, you know, I know we're going to talk about Rutger Hauer in a second, but, you know, his character, that's why I don't think we connect with him, because if you're this ancient guy, why are you killing a bunch of horny teenagers? Why aren't you killing like people? Why aren't you killing CEOs and taking over companies and corporations? Why do you care? You know, we know you're a bad guy, but we don't know what your motivation is. You want to kill Buffy. Okay, but why? Why do you want to kill Buffy?
And that's a perfect segue into Rutger Hauer, who, by the way, as of recording this, passed away a few days ago at the age of 75, and was always somebody that gave a good performance no matter what. No matter how small the role, no matter how small the budget, he always had the it factor for me. And I always found him, and this is where it's going to get really interesting, because when you look at movies like The Hitcher or even Lady Hawk, where he's actually a good person in Lady Hawk, I still think and still found him to have this real menacing quality about him. Like, he was terrifying. That being said, none of that is in this movie whatsoever. And it was the first and perhaps the only time that I can ever say that I was disappointed by a Rutger Hauer performance. What are your thoughts?
I mean, yeah, I completely agree. I mean, his speech at the end of Blade Runner is one of my favorite moments in film ever. I absolutely adored him as an actor, and he's just not. And again, I don't think it's his fault, just like I don't think it's Christy Swanson's fault. I think that you're dealing with a script that didn't know what it was doing. And his character is an example of that. You know, we, again, he has no motivation. His costuming is terrible. His hair is terrible. I mean, he's just very, he's a distraction more than he is a motivating factor in watching. So
talk about Donald Sutherland just for a moment here, because look, facts are facts. The man is an amazing actor, and he might be the highlight for me in this movie as far as someone giving a very good performance with what they have to work with. And perhaps maybe that's because he rewrote some of his own dialogue. I didn't even know that until you brought that up. He's not in the movie a whole lot, but I think he's serviceable for this film.
Yeah, I think he's fine. I mean, you know, I do get these moments. You know, I made a quip earlier about how, you know, he may be reliving part of his previous horror. You know, there's moments where I feel like he's very much Don't Look Now, Donald Sutherland, with the trench coats and things like that. And that kind of took me out of it. But yeah, I mean, he's fine. But again, who is he? What is his motivation? You know, I think, you know, there's a big change from the movie to the television show with who the Watcher is. And there's this whole Watchers Council, and he isn't reincarnated. There's tons of Watchers. And even if they don't have a Slayer, even if they aren't looking after the Slayer, they're there. And there's more motivation. There's more world building. And I think he suffers from the same thing that the Slayer herself does, in the sense that we just don't know who this guy is, and we don't understand why this young girl is going to go off with him and believe him. I mean, he's a little strange and unapproachable, which I don't think works. And that's why I think Anthony Stewart Head's performance coming in the next episode that we'll talk about is so much more powerful, because he's much more relatable. He's not as creepy. He doesn't seem dangerous. You know, he's more academic. You know, those things, I think, you know, Donald Sutherland's character would have benefited from.
And I think this, just to keep going back there, I think we all would have benefited from a longer movie with mm-hmm. with a little bit more exposition spelled out. We briefly mentioned that Hilary Swank, this was her first on-screen performance. The problem with this is I'm so used to her in such heavy roles. To see this performance was very much just like, oh, okay, this is someone who's just desperately, I think, trying to break into the business, is just going to take whatever part they can get, and hopefully, you know, this will turn into something, which obviously it did, because, you know, she's amazing in a lot of things, but completely, I mean, let's be honest, it's just a completely forgettable character in this film.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. It's terrible. I mean, what I think is amazing is only 7 years later, she would give us that amazing performance in Boys Don't Cry. I mean, what happened? I don't know what acting classes she went to. Yeah. I don't know what agent she changed to. But, you know, in those 7 years, the fact that she went from this to that, I think, is a really huge, huge break for her.
So if we can talk about the highlight of the movie, if there is a highlight of the movie, it is Paul Reubens in this film. Because as much as we've talked about the decisions that he's made, the things that he's done, I don't think anyone can dispute that Paul Reubens is an excellent actor. All you have to do is look at Pee-wee. You look at any role he's taken. Look at the performance he does in Blow, in Mystery Men. I mean, he is a very good actor. And he, you know, he's given limited things to do in this one, but I had to remind myself a few times watching this, oh my God, that's Pee-wee Herman. Like this, he actually turns into this character. And again, if I have to heap some praise on this film, I mean, he was the best part of the movie for me. And he's only in it for a very limited time.
Oh, I think absolutely everybody agrees with that. I mean, his death scene is the only part of the film that I laugh at. I mean, he's very good in it, and he's funny, and he gets some of the best lines as well. Like, you know, what is it? Kill them all a lot or something like that. Like, that's such a Whedon line. You know, he gets some of those lines, and he does the most with them. So I think that he's great. He's the bright spot in an otherwise really wah-wah-wah, you know, film.
So the movie was released in theaters. It was a summer release, July 31st, 1992, made on a $7 million budget. You know, sometimes we like to say, hey, well, $7 million, I can't believe they pulled that off for $7 million. This looks like a movie that was made for $7 million. I mean, that's the reality. It debuted at number 5 at the North American box office, which is not very good. I have to believe at this point that the studio, like these big studios, they're not stupid. Like when they do test screenings for these movies, they probably put no money behind the marketing. It's like, all right, we made the movie. It was made for $7 million. If we pop it into theaters, maybe it will double its money back and we can just, it's a wash. Ended up making a little over $16 million during its run. Now, the critical reception currently stands with a 35% on Rotten Tomatoes, which I will assume, based on everything that I've been doing or everything I've been reading, this will be the lowest Rotten Tomatoes score of any of the films that we talk about, hands down. And it has an average of 4.3 on Metacritic. And the consensus reads that Buffy the Vampire Slayer supernatural coming of age tale is a letdown by poor directing and even poor plotting. Like you said, you nailed it. And they say, though Christy Swanson and Paul Reubens' game performances still managed to slay. This was a disaster. This did not go well. And it's kind of amazing that Whedon was able to make the TV series after, like, who's coming behind him? Who's he going to saying, listen, I want to do the Buffy TV series. And I will get into that when we do the next episode, when we get into the history of how that show came. But the lingering questions I have as we wrap up this episode is, who's even saying, who at the WB is going, let's make a TV series of this disaster of a movie. It's very interesting.
I mean, it's a miracle of Hollywood. You know, not many of them happen. Not many things get a rebirth that is that successful, because the television show would come and it would be life-changing for people. And again, I'm not overstating that. It would become truly life-changing for people. I mean, I rewatch Buffy the Vampire Slayer every year. I rewatch the whole series. My son is almost 4 and he can quote lines from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Like, you know, I mean, it's a big part of my life and my brother's life and a lot of my friends' lives and pop culture. And Sarah Michelle Gellar was just this amazing. I mean, you know, we'll get into the, you know, a lot of the queer characters and what they did and the storylines and how important it was for the time period it, you know, it came out. And I think that, you know, it's a miracle of Hollywood. And a lot of it is because of what Joss Whedon did after this movie. I mean, all of the things, like the connections he made in Hollywood, the writing that he was doing, his connection with Pixar and Toy Story and the script doctoring he would continue to do throughout the 90s. I think he just gained enough credit that they let him do it. And we'll get into it in the next episode of what the WB was and why it was a perfect place for the show to come on and what it did for the WB, which is how we got things like the CW and Freeform and all of these big TV stations would have never existed without the WB, and that WB wouldn't have existed without Buffy. So we'll get into that next episode. But watching this, you know, you just go, wow. And I have to say, I did not talk about my first time watching this. I watched this film long before I saw the television show. This wasn't a situation where I don't like this movie because I saw the TV show first. I mean, I remember watching this maybe around the same time Clueless came out, you know, 96. I was 13, so it would have been about 96. And I remember watching it because Luke Perry was in it. I mean, that's why I watched it. But it's just, it's not a good film. But the bones of an amazing character are there. And luckily they were resurrected. But if this was all we got, we certainly wouldn't have put this on our vampire retrospective.
No, and for sure. I really want the listeners to understand that this had to be talked about in order for us to segue into what is arguably one of the biggest influences of the past 25, 30 years in vampire culture, which is Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So what we like to do at the end of each one of these episodes is we like to assign a rating scale, if you will, on how we would rate this movie. And we, since it's a vampire retrospective, it is how many stakes through the heart would you give this out of 10? So Ashley, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, 1992, how many stakes through the heart are you giving this film?
So I've tried to this whole time make my ratings be about not just the enjoyment I get from watching these films, but the significance of them to vampire culture. So that's made this very complicated for me, because if I were doing just the film, it would be a 1. But, you know, adding in the significance because of what it produced, I'm going to put it at a solid 4.
Okay, that's exactly what I wrote down. I just gave it 4 for pretty much the similar reasons, because without that, we don't get what is probably going to be the most popular episode of all the vampire series that we do. Like, it's important. It has to be done.
It does. And I just want to say to all of you on Twitter that keep direct messaging me asking, I'm getting harassed, Dana, about when we're going to do our Buffy the Television Show episode. I promise it is coming, but please keep sending me your favorite episodes because I've gone back and rewatched some of them. And I just want to give a shout out to my brother, Jordan Lord, who is listening, and just say that he gave me the most amazing birthday present that I did not know existed. Those of you that are true Buffy fans, he gave me a vinyl copy of the Once More with Feeling musical episode for my birthday. It is a vinyl record. It is blood red. It comes with a sleigh bill with the lyrics rather than a playbill. It is the most awesome. Amazing thing ever. I already posted some pictures on Twitter. I'll post them again with a link to where you can purchase it, because if you're into vinyl like I am and you're into Buffy like I am, it is the absolute perfect gift, surprise, or treat yourself type day thing to go get. So I just want to give a shout out to him. Best present ever.
Outstanding. So Ashley, if people want to follow you on social media, how can they do that?
Sure. You can follow me at Ashley Schlafly on Twitter and, let us know what you think of this episode and any of other movies you want us to cover.
Outstanding. All right. If you want to follow this show on Twitter, it's at Dana Buckler Show. I'm personally on Twitter at Dana Buckler. You can also follow us on Instagram at The Dana Buckler Show, and you can email the show with questions or comments at thedanabucklershow@gmail.com. All right. So Ashley, looking forward to hitting the ground running on the Buffy series. I will let the listeners know that I will be watching the series for the very first time, as I have never seen a single episode, and I'm getting very, very excited. So thank you so much for being on the show, and looking forward to talking to you very soon.
Great.
And my name is Dana Buckler, and thank you so much for listening.